UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on bethinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Now then, we come down from Kierkegaard, we come to the modern world, and specifically the existentialist world. And the existentialist can be divided in various ways, but perhaps the simplest way is between the three countries of France, Switzerland and Germany. And in France, of course, you have Sartre and Camus. In Germany, you have Heidegger. And a man that is not as well known in this country, but I think in some ways is more important than Sartre and Camus in the real drive of things, Karl Jaspers in Switzerland. Now, Heidegger, in a way, is the Sartre and Camus would be more important to discuss simply because they are better known. Heidegger would be more important to discuss because he has had more influence on theology, for those of us who have some interest in theology, than any of the others. But Karl Jaspers is the most important in a sense because he says what he wants to say so clearly. And Karl Jaspers runs a system like this. Karl Jaspers says, here is a line. And down here is rationality. Now, in the next lecture, I would like, don't get to it tonight, to show a parallel between this and the thinking of Leonardo da Vinci at the time of the Renaissance itself. But Karl Jaspers would see rationality equaling mathematics, quite properly, equaling machines in a very real way. And as such, one finds it very hard, one finds it impossible, on the basis of logic and rationality, to come to any real grips with the problem of purpose or meaning in life. One can find talk about machinery down here in the area of rationality and logic, but in the area of personality, of purpose, of meaning, of significance, rationality gives no answers, according to this view. And as such, you put up here non-logic and non-rationality. And in the area of non-logic and non-rationality, and one must play this game completely squarely, or you miss the thing, and that is that when you say non-logic and non-rationality, you mean non-logic and non-rationality. You can't bring rationality and logic in as a ringer after you've started. And in the area of non-logic and non-rationality, you have the final experience. The final experience. The final experience is that you have a... now you see I spelled it out. In the final experience, you experience that which, like a streak of lightning, gives you an experience of purpose, an experience of meaning. And then that's it. This would seem a solution to the problem. The only difficulty with, and this is the problem in it, is that if it's really in the area of non-logic and non-rationality, it means you can't communicate your experience. So you're a silent man. And it would be bad enough to be silent with everybody else, but you have to be silent to yourself. Because if it is really a non-rational, non-logical experience, it is not only that you cannot communicate it to other people, but you cannot communicate it to yourself either. All you can say is the next morning, and I've worked with many of these people, and they've had an experience, a final experience. And they say, I've had a final experience. And they don't expect me to say what, how, because then because they think I am among the initiated, and this would mark me among the non-initiated. So you never say, what is the experience? You never say, talk to me about it. You just say, well. And this is fine, but suddenly there is a problem. If everything in life, if every purpose, every motion of significance, every motion of purpose, every movement of love, every thought of morality, higher than the concept of social contract, hangs upon an experience, how desperate it is to hang on to that experience. But if you cannot talk about it, in the evening you may say, this morning I had it, But the next morning you must say it was yesterday. And the next day you say it was 2 days ago. And in a week you say it was a week ago. And I've met these men, and they're beaten in this situation. The existentialist as a whole has this answer. Of course, Sartre would postulate it slightly different. The leap into the observed by the act of the will. But you have the final experience, or you have experience, or you have, in LSD, let us say, experience. And these are all related. Aldous Huxley's presentation of the use of drugs was not only escape. I know the person who provided drugs for Aldous Huxley in Paris. I know the family. And this was a very serious thing with Aldous Huxley. But with Aldous Huxley, never think of the taking of drugs as merely an escape. He sets forth with great intensity that it also is a way to a first order knowledge. In other words, above rationality, above logic, without rationality, the hope that through this means would come the experience whereby he would smash into reality and have some place to stay. With Paul Sartre, with Jean-Paul Sartre, of course, the dilemma is that there is no way to postulate in a totally absurd situation which has meaning in its parts. This is a mathematical difficulty, to put it mildly. If the thing is absurd as a whole, it is difficult to maintain there is any real rather than merely psychological subjective meaning simply by willing to move in a direction if it doesn't matter in which direction one would move. It is not only, however, existentialism that finds itself in this dilemma. If one would go to Oxford and study logic, the Anglo-Saxon theological world, and you come to logical positivism, you have the same kind of a situation. Logical positivism has the dilemma, and the reason I would put it under the line of despair, of a tremendous first step of faith. The first step of faith being the acceptance without a reason for doing so, the acceptance that the stuff which reaches you from outside may be called data. And this is a tremendous act of faith. A tremendous act of faith. Without any philosophic base, with no reason for saying so, the claimant will prove each point as he goes on, to accept the fact that this is data is a tremendous step of faith. And the men in Oxford are not doing well with their logical positivism at exactly this point. I had a boy who was pressing logical positivism who came to us for a time, and I enjoyed talking with him very, very much. And he asked to present logical positivism at a Farrell House lecture. And so we were glad, and he started. And he, in the first two sentences, he mentioned the word data about two times. And I said, you mustn't do this. You're cheating. The word data is loaded with connotation. It is a connotation word. It is a word that assumes objectivity. And you haven't proved it. So he said, what do you want me to do? I agree. So I said, every time you're going to use the word data, use the word blip instead. So he started, when the blip reaches you. We may laugh, but it's also something for which to cry. Because this is despair. In the sense of despair that I'm speaking of despair tonight. Not despair in the sense of weeping, but despair of giving up any hope of establishing a circle which will encompass knowledge and encompass life. The defining philosophers have exactly the same problem at Cambridge. And the defining philosophers would be the first one to acknowledge that so far they're only dealing with prolegomena. And they would say, all we're doing is defining terms in the hope that someday we will have enough terms defined that we can put two sticks together sometime. But there is no claim in these philosophic systems that they are standing in the place where the old philosophy stood. So I think it is totally fair, though one might quarrel with my word, despair, it is perfectly fair to speak of them as having a similarity even while they have, and of course they have, such tremendous differences. But I feel their similarity is in the area of giving up this hope which has marked educated men, philosophic thought of the past. I think the second step can be said to be in the arts. Art has always been ahead of music in this regard. that has come in art. Just as you have here, a doorway. So the doorway in the arts, of course, would be the Impressionists. The Impressionists, as they began, were classical. They were simply interested in following the problem of light, as Turner had been before them. Goya, on the other hand, had already blazed the way for a different thing that came out in the Impressionists after they fought and scattered to the south of France. What you find is that Van Gogh, the three great names of Van Gogh, Gauguin, and Cézanne, all broke through the line from the being the doorway, the classical side, down into under this line. If you read the letters to his brother Leo, for example, it's very, very plain that Van Hawk or Van Gogh did not commit suicide simply because Gauguin took his women, as is so largely said. It is not so. He had set forth to his brother Leo a hope. The hope was that the really sensitive people, the artists, would be able to establish a new religion, a humanist religion, in the south of France, in a community, and there show the world to a great light. Gauguin was the first man who appeared in that community. After a very short time, a matter of a couple months, they had a horrible fight, and the community was spoiled, it was smashed, and Van Hawk never regained his balance until it led him to the place of suicide. Gauguin did the same thing, and you have no reason, if you attend your museum here in Boston, you have the greatest demonstration of this that you can find anywhere, and that is right here, his great work, What, Whence, Whither. Each person should realize what this means if he is going to understand Gauguin's dilemma. Gauguin went to Tahiti. His concept was a concept that many people still follow, and that is the concept of finding some absolute in the area of the primitive, the noble savage. And he drew his beautiful women, he drew his exotic backgrounds, and he had hope of meaning in these things which he drew. But if you will go over here, and we should be over there to see it, but you'll notice that when he did this tremendous painting, large in size as well as in thrust, he spoiled it from an artistic viewpoint by putting his title in French on the two corners. If there's anything spoils a picture, it's that. But he was willing to spoil the picture because it wasn't a picture to him, but in what he wrote in his letters, he declared it was a philosophic poem. A philosophic poem. He painted this picture in 1897 and 1898. And he said in his letters, I have finished a philosophic work on this theme compared to the gospel. The same sort of thing, of course, that Gauguin had said, in relating this to a religious concept. A figure lifts up its arms in the air and is astonished, looking at these two personages who dare to think of their direction. He says here he's painted somebody who has a care for what, whence, whither. And there is a figure holding up his arms in utter astonishment of asking the question, what, whence, whither. And then he says something further in his letter. He points out that there is the end of the painting, because he tells us to read it not from the left to the right, but the right to the left. And he points out that the next to the last figure is an old woman dying. And then he does it in a couplet, like a poem, in his writing. And he says the end of the matter is whither, close to the death of an old woman, a strange, stupid bird concludes. That is, concludes the painting, concludes the poem. He's simply saying, this old woman is dying. I can paint these women as beautiful as I wish. They may be beautiful, but in a little while they are like this, and I do not know the answer to what, whence, whither. And my hope of finding a meaning in the primitive, in the noble savage, turns to dust in my teeth, and I've learned to hate it. And what most people don't realize is that he painted this picture and he attempted suicide. He was not successful, as Van Hawk had been. But he tried suicide, and he never painted another great painting. It was the end of Gauguin. Gauguin had tried to find a universal, had failed and broken forth into the area of despair, in this basic sense I am using. Cézanne tried another universal. It was the universal with geometrical form. If you examine his typical pictures, his landscapes, he rarely did it with figures, though he sometimes did, but his landscapes look like a membrane pulled over, clear-cut, basic, geometrical form. In this, he had a clear relationship to that Greek philosophy, of course, which would have said that the answer would be in mathematics. He never, as far as I know, I've searched and searched, I've never found that he went through the trapdoor into the area of despair. But the one who followed him did, and that is Picasso. And we know that Picasso knew Gauguin and knew him well and was with him a number of times at the home of Gertrude Stein in Paris. And Picasso is a bringing together of Gauguin's concept of the primitive, such as the Mademoiselle de Vignoles, where he brings into the primitive masks, and Cézanne in geometrical form. Picasso tried to find a universal in abstraction, but there's a problem with finding a universal in abstraction, and that is at the moment you almost have it, where you're not painting your model, but you're painting woman, and you've almost made it, suddenly she disappears from the canvas. And this is a tragic thing, and Picasso felt this, and Picasso was battered to pieces, because he was thinking philosophically in a way that Braque did not seem to think. And he was battered to pieces. And at that particular moment, he fell in love. And he wrote, "Gem Eva, I love Eva," on his canvas. It didn't have anything to do with what he was painting. It might have been a stool. And he established communication with the person in front of him. And that blazes the way for the problem of modern man. The problem of modern man did not begin with cybernetics and so on, and the computer. It began with Picasso trying to find a way of universalizing and losing communication in a human sense with a man in front of his canvas who no longer knew what he was trying to say. After this, Picasso never again was the leader of the avant-garde in Europe. Instead of this, there was a man by the name of Modrian and de Staël that picked this up. Modrian, we all know, is marvelous horizontals and verticals, but it isn't just a balance. To Modrian, he was trying to carry on Picasso's concept. He and others worked out the style, and they had a magazine, which they called the style. And happily, I was able to see the last issue. And in it, this is the poem with which they closed the issues of the style, and it was never printed again. The head downwards, the leg upwards, he tumbles into the bottomless from whence he came. He has no more honor in his body. He bites no more bite of any short meal. He answers no greeting and is not proud when being adored. The head downwards, the leg upward, he tumbles into the bottomless from whence he came, like a dish covered with hair, like a four-legged sucking chair, like a death echo trunk, half full, half empty. The head downwards, the legs upward, he tumbles into the bottomless from whence he came. And de Staël had tumbled through the trapdoor into full-fledged despair. And from that you move on to Dada, and you have Marcel Duchamp, and these other men in Zurich, who picked the name for their school even by flipping open the dictionary and putting their finger down by chance, who wrote their poems further out than what we have just read by cutting out words out of a newspaper, putting them in the hat, scattering them by chance, and saying this is poetry. And so we find that down through from this school we come to Dada and then, of course, to surrealism, which was a combination of Dada, the nothingness plus the subconscious. And this is surrealism. In music, you have many forms. Musique concrète was worked out by Paul Schaeffer in Paris. And what he dealt with in musique concrète, it's not electronic sound. It's a very different thing. Electronic sound is manufactured sound. Musique concrète is real sound made relative. And this is musique concrète. First of all, he worked by jumping a disc, jumping the grooves. But of course, this didn't give too much. And then he invented a machine with tape, which is a marvelous machine. He can take a sound of any kind, he can split it, he can run it backwards, he can distort it, he can make it go fast, he can make it go slow, he can move it in one place, one relationship or another. And his whole concept is the demonstration not just that sound is relative, but something far more. That sound leads to disintegration when it's seen in this way. Despair, in the very real words. So now we're down here to our own day in art. Here we're down to music concrete in music. In general culture, you can think of Dylan Thomas's poetry, beautiful poetry, but that which is certainly broken in its emphasis. You can think of James Osborne, for example, who's been called an idealist without an ideal. It would be very difficult to think of a sadder sentence than this. He's not just a man who doesn't care. I know people who know Osborne, and he's not a man who doesn't care. He's changed his whole way of life to try to find something. He's moved into the Swiss Alps. As a matter of fact, very, very close to us. where we live there. And he's tried to find something. He isn't just someone who doesn't care at all. Osborne is something and very different. Osborne is a man who cares, but he can't find anything to care about. And this is a much greater form of despair. I would mention Henry Miller. I would say Henry Miller is in the same situation. Henry Miller, people would say, would write dirty books. But Henry Miller writes something else. These are a philosophic expression. It is not nothing when people say that Miller writes philosophy. He writes a philosophy that the best word I know for it is the Dutch word of anti-law. The denial of antithesis of meaning at any level. Such a place we suddenly regurgitate over into the fact that even there must be a law of anti-law brought into contact with the male and the female. And what we're left is a philosophic expression of homosexuality. Here we have in each of these areas, and we could go on into more and more detail of what I mean by the fact that there is a uniform fabric to our culture. There is something that's happened, which indeed can be called a chasm of despair, which separates us from the previous generation further than they were separated from the time of the Renaissance.